Thanks very, very much, Penny Davey. Thanks for that introduction. And I remember you as someone who had to turn your hand to anything very cheerfully when we worked together, so that's nice. And really nice to be a guest of the class. I think actually this is my first time to the Thursday women's class. It's our order chapter evening on a Thursday night, so I'm usually with some other friends in the order having our chapter evening. But I've got the night off that tonight to come here. Really nice to be here. And I think this is the beginning of a new series, is that right? About different people's encounters with the Buddha. So I was asked to talk about a story of the encounter of someone with the Buddha. And we're lucky enough to have quite a lot of stories about different people's encounters with the Buddha. And I've heard quite a lot of these before, and I thought, I'm going to find one that I haven't heard before to talk about. So I looked in this little book called Encounters with Enlightenment, which has got about 30 or 35 stories of different encounters with the Buddha. And it's funny, isn't it, how sometimes, for a reason that you don't really know, something just strikes you. So Uga's encounter with the Buddha, it's a very, very simple story, which I'll tell you in a minute, but it just, I didn't really know why. I thought, oh, that's the one. So I'm sort of exploring it for myself as much as sharing it with you. Sometimes it's like that, isn't it? Something strikes you and you don't really know why. It was in this book, and then I looked it up in the Pali Canon as well. I've got a bit more on it. But as I say, it's a very, very simple story. But I think quite a lot can be drawn out of it. So who was Uga? So Uga, he lived in a place called Hatigama, and he was a banker. So he was a young banker. So I was thinking, in the modern day, he'd be just a young bloke who works in the city, and he liked to party. So Uga really liked to party. And on this occasion, him and his friends had been in the forest partying for 7 days and nights in a row. So he was quite drunk, basically. So, and disheveled and sort of dissipated. You know, they had taken a sort of troop of dancing girls with them. Anyway, we can only imagine what they were all getting up to together, but it was 7 days and nights of it, whatever it was. I thought that's interesting for a start. I don't know, that number seven's quite interesting. I don't know, somebody probably knows better than me I don't know if in the time of the Buddha they measured the days of the week in sevens or not, but I thought if they did, I don't know, there's something about like a whole week, like he was drunk for a whole week. He was drunk for a whole 7 days. That seems to say something in itself, that every single day he was drunk. And, that state of drunkenness, there's the literal state of drunkenness, but also it's quite strong as a metaphor, isn't it? It's often in Buddhism talked about a sort of state of ignorance. And, it's also quite a... it's definitely a state of disintegration. If any of you have ever been drunk, you'll know that. You can't really handle yourself when you're drunk. And if you encounter somebody who's drunk, even if they're benignly drunk, you don't really fully. You can't really trust them. You know, somebody drunk who swears to be your lifelong friend or swears they're in love with you or something, that you take it with a pinch of salt, don't you? You're not, they might sort of mean it at the time, but they only mean it at the time. When they sober up, they might not even remember what they've said. So in that way, somebody who's drunk isn't integrated. They're sort of relying on their friends who are hopefully more sober to help them make wise decisions. Somebody who's drunk doesn't make wise decisions, you know. They often, they kind of swear they'll be able to drive home safely, and if luckily they might have a friend who kind of takes the car keys off them or whatever. So I think the state of being drunk is sort of, well, literally and metaphorically quite a strong, yeah, it's a state of disintegration. So anyway, there was Ugar in this state of dissipation, drunkenness, disintegration. And they were reveling around in the forest. Unbeknownst to them, the Buddha was in that same forest, meditating in a clearing. And, well, there he was. The Buddha was just, like, doing his own thing, as it were, just meditating in the clearing. And Ugar and his friends stumbled across the Buddha. And, well, what did they do? The Buddha didn't do anything. The Buddha just carried on meditating. You can sort of imagine the scene. Just sat there and just carried on. And we're told that some of his companions, some of Ugar's companions, made fun of the Buddha. They just were sort of thinking, oh, look at him, you know, sitting there meditating. He doesn't know how to live, you know. Other ones sort of slunk away, you know. They felt almost as if, although the Buddha wasn't doing anything, you get the sense that the Buddha's presence was like a reprimand to them. So they sort of slunk away. But the effect on Ugar was different. It had a very dramatic and instant effect on Ugar, and immediately on seeing the serene figure of the Buddha, he was seized with shame, but it was, and I'm going to explore this more, it was a positive shame, in that instantly his drunkenness disappeared and his mind became clear. So on the spot, he realised what a state he was in, and he was just sobered up immediately. And then he paid respect to the Buddha and sat with the Buddha, and the Buddha taught him. And we're told on that very night, Ugar became what's called a non-returner. So a non-returner is someone whose spiritual momentum has reached such a momentum that not only can they never fall back, but they're never again compelled into a human birth. They might take a human birth in order to help all beings, but they're not compelled to sort of be reborn. Or we could look at that as they're not compelled to repeat old patterns ever again. A whole new way of life opens up to them. So that happened that very night with Ugar. And interesting enough, he stayed as a banker. Yeah, so he didn't become a monk, so he's still a banker. And he became one of the Buddha's leading lay disciples. So he we're told he served the monks. He was very generous, so the banking, he was probably quite well off, so he was able to materially be generous to the community of monks. And he served the monks, and just as a little aside about how he served the monks, and this isn't the sort of main point of the talk, but I really liked this. He said that if a monk was preaching, he listened to them. But if the monk wasn't preaching, he gave the discourse. And I really like that, because you get that sense of he just did what needs to be done. You know, he didn't kind of push himself forward and say, oh, I'll teach if the monk was preaching. But neither if teaching was needed, he would. But if just tidying up was needed, he would do that. So he just, I really like that. I think I like it because I think that that's the way that we're trying to build the Sangha here at this Buddhist centre, that in a way, you know, well, I happen to be giving the talk tonight, maybe tomorrow night I'll be doing the washing up, you know, or the same with anyone here. You know, you might be helping to make the tea, or you might be helping to support a retreat, or, you know, it's just that idea of doing what needs done, that no one's, it's not about, you know, the teacher doesn't have the highest status, is what I'm trying to say. It's just, yeah, you just do whatever needs done at the time. So I really like that. So what I wanted to talk about in the rest of this talk is just what happened. Just this idea of that he was instantly sobered up. And this idea that he was, we're told he was seized with shame, which the word shame has often got not a positive connotation for us. But here I think it has got a positive connotation, so what could that mean? So I'm going to talk for a bit. I'm I hope and there might be time for some discussions. I never quite know how much I'm going to say, so we'll see what happens. I shall talk for a bit, and then if there's a chance for a discussion, that would be nice too. So I'm going to, as I say, explore what could be meant by this sort of positive sense of shame that Uga was seized with, that had the effect of turning him from drunkenness to sobriety, to awakeness in just an instant. So I think the word that's been used as shame here is a traditional Buddhist word called apatrapia, and I've written this down on the flip chart, which I'll show you in a minute, which is the third of a list, a traditional Buddhist list, of what's called the 11 positive mental events. What's the other way? You're right, thank goodness I got that. So, apatrapia, so it's that one there. And so that's the third of the three. So, the first one is Shraddha, which means faith. And the second one is Hri, which also means positive shame. But in a minute, there's a distinction between these two, which I'm going to go into in a minute. So these two words, so Hri, which is actually, Hri is usually translated as shame as such, and apatrapi is usually translated as respect for wise opinion, but it's kind of a variety of this Hri, or positive remorse or shame, because it's respect for wise opinion in the sense of, well, in the sense that Uga felt it when he came across the Buddha. It was in relation to the Buddha. So apatrapi is when you feel it in relation to someone else, yeah? To someone else who's wiser than yourself. It's a bit like you see, free is when you feel remorse about an unskillful action. And apatrapi is like when you view that unskillful action through the eyes of someone you look up to. Okay, and Shraddha, as I say, is faith. So, and there's a very strong link between these three. In a way, you don't get Hri and apatrapi if you don't have Shraddha. Shraddha underpins them all. So I'm going to try and explore that this evening. So one important point to make about both Hri and apatrapia is that they're painful but positive. I think this is quite important because often we use the word positive, especially in the English language, in a kind of quite a loose way. Usually when we say positive, we often think we're talking about something pleasurable. We often use them sort of synonymously. We say, oh, I felt positive, when what we mean is we felt happy or we felt pleasure. And it might be, sometimes we do feel both positive and happy, and both positive and a pleasurable feeling. But this draws out that from the Buddhist point of view, you could feel something painful, in particular this Hri or remorse and apatrapi or respect for wise opinion. Well, as we know, it's not... if we feel that, it's not a pleasant feeling, but from a Buddhist point of view, it's highly positive, it's highly skillful. So I want to go into that a bit more, because I think confusing positive and pleasure can lead us into, well, quite a lot of sort of confusion and trouble and sort of even doubt, actually. If we think we should always be feeling happy all the time, and if we think that if we're not feeling happy, we've somehow gone wrong in our spiritual life, then that can bring a sort of unnecessary doubt. It's not necessarily that because we're not feeling particularly happy that we've gone wrong. Yeah. So. And I think this connects with how we experience Shraddha or faith, because again, we can we can hear this word faith, so we probably know, if we know anything about Buddhism, that faith in Buddhism doesn't mean blind belief. So that's one important distinction to make. It can sometimes be described as confidence. However, confidence doesn't kind of fully do it justice. There's much more to it than just simply confidence. I like more poetic descriptions, such as the one I like best is it means placing our heart upon. I like that because it's got both the sort of emotional aspect of the heart, but also it's got an action. It's like we place our heart, we do something, we place our heart upon something, we commit ourselves. Another even more poetic one is I think Sangharaksha says, Shraddha's when what's ultimate in us resonates with what's ultimate in the universe. So that gives more of a flavour of what faith means in Buddhism. But I think we can sometimes make a mistake with when we think about Shraddha as well, in that we can think it's synonymous or it's the same thing as feeling devotion. It might be, or it might not, because Shraddha is not simply a feeling. So sometimes we might feel really devotional, like we might do a puja or a Buddhist ritual or some chanting, and we might have, you know, very kind of enjoyable sort of feeling of uplift, and we might think, oh, I'm feeling a lot of Shraddha at the moment. So we might be, but at the same time we might, but what that can lead us to thinking is if we don't feel that feeling of uplift, we might think, oh, I've not got any Shraddha because I don't feel that feeling of uplift. And that's where we've got to be careful, because the feeling of uplift might be synonymous with Shraddha, but you could have Shraddha without the feeling of uplift. And again, that's what I want to spend a little bit of time on, because again, that can lead us into unnecessary doubt, because we think, oh, I'm not feeling that kind of lovely feeling. Where's my faith gone? I think I feel quite passionate about this because I've seen it happen so many times with people. They call their Shraddha into question because they don't feel certain sort of feelings. But actually, Shraddha is not a feeling. It's an action. It's a volition. It's a karma, if you like. Karma meaning action. So I want to tell you a little bit about what Subhuti says in this little booklet called Remorse and Confession in the Spiritual Community. This is my little Bible, actually. It's so well thumbed. I've got so much highlighting in it. There's actually hardly any unhighlighted bits. So I'll just tell you what he says, and hopefully that'll shed light on what I'm trying to get at. So he says, well, a bit similar, he says that he suspects that too often we think of Shraddha in its emotional aspect, and also that that leads us to having an unrealistic idea of how strong that should be. He says we look for a sort of exhilarating fizz of inspiration filling our consciousness. But he says that's not Shraddha necessarily, and it's not even its most characteristic mode. He says Shraddha is not always an obvious experience. And he goes on to say something that I quite like this. He says Shraddha is often a subterranean power rather than the operatic thrill that we imagine it to be. And he says it's most clearly visible in how we orientate our life, yeah, which in turn manifests in what we actually choose to do with our life. So he says and he goes on to give a bit of a metaphor for this underlying orientation. He says, well, yeah, it might not always manifest itself dramatically in terms of inspired moods or intense feelings of devotion. He says those intense feelings, it's a bit like, maybe I'll draw that picture, so it's a bit like you've got this underwater mountain range, okay? So imagine all this is under the water. So these intense sort of moods, they're like little islands, you know, so that's what you can see. So you see these little islands sort of emerging from this deep sea. But only the highest peaks are visible. But actually, even when there's nothing breaking the surface, maybe the water rises a bit more, and there's nothing breaking the surface, these mountains are still there, and they're quite substantial. And they're sort of exerting a pull, you know, they've got that sort of gravitational pull on this water. They're affecting the currents of this water, because they're affecting the way the water flows. So that's a bit like they're affecting the way we're living our life. So he makes that quite important point. And then he makes another kind of related point, which brings us back to these ones. He says another way that we can experience our Shraddha, so here it is, it's all under, how are we going to experience it if it's all underwater? So we can experience it in looking at the way the course of our life is directed. You know, even in simple things like, well, here we all are here tonight. That must mean something. Even if we're not feeling any operatic thrills of inspiration, well, we have kind of come out on a Thursday night. And maybe, you know, maybe you come Thursday after Thursday. Something brings you here. You know, something brings you back. So he's saying, like, give yourself credit for that, even at times when you're not, you know, you might be feeling, oh, I'm not feeling very inspired at the moment. Well, just look at your actions. You're turning up. You know, you're turning up to your meditation practice. Or you can look back over the course of your life, especially since you've started practicing maybe, and, you know, think, well, have I become more kind, more generous? You know, you can reflect on that to give you confidence. But he says another way that we can have a more direct and sort of conscious sense of Shraddha is in our desire to be ethical. Yeah. So he says that the sort of dharmic impulse is in the first stages of our practice. Well, actually, I would say it's for a long time. Actually, really, till we're enlightened, really, is mainly an ethical impulse. And he says we'll experience our Shraddha most consciously when it clashes against the opposing forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. And it's like the spark between our Shraddha and the opposing forces, i.e. when we do something unskillful, like get drunk in the case of Uga, that produces sparks. Yeah, so that clash produces sparks, and these sparks are free remorse and apatrapia, which is remorse kind of in relation to someone we look up to. So I really like that. I like that sort of that notion of the spark, that you wouldn't have the free and apatrapia if you didn't have the Shraddha, even if you don't think you have Shraddha. You see, Uga's probably when he's, if you asked him, you know, there he is, this dissipated banker, well, his, you know, if you asked him at the time, well, are you kind of experiencing Shraddha, he'd probably say no, you know. But actually the argument is he must have been, or else he would, why did he respond to the Buddha like that? It was almost like there must have been these subterranean mountains, or there must have been something in him that knew there was a better way to live. And in a way you could say that's what Shraddha is, that but there was them that knows there's a better way to live than this. He comes in contact with the Buddha and then there's a spark, and that's the apatrapia. And that spark was dramatic enough in Uga's case to completely sort of sober him up in that moment. So that's why whenever we feel this feeling of remorse or apatrapia, we can, even though it's painful, we kind of need to learn to be pleased about it, because from a dharmic point of view, it's a positive thing. So, okay, so I've got quite a lot more I want to say about this, because I can imagine you might have some questions in your mind already about this. I hope you have, anyway. So we're saying that it's a positive thing. Because if we... So the absence of it. So if we were, so it's interesting that you've got Ugo with his friends. So his friends go in different directions. Some of them make fun of the Buddha, and some of them kind of guiltily slink away. So I want to talk about those two sets of friends and how, what those responses mean as well. So I think the friends that kind of just make fun of the Buddha, it's like that's the exact opposite of hri and apatrapia. They don't feel any sort of remorse at all. They just are kind of going, kind of nyah nyah, look at him, like we don't care. We're just kind of going to go on getting drunk, and like he's really silly for sitting there meditating. So, yeah, so that is that. That's the exact opposite of it. So, let's see, I think Subhuti's got something to say about that as well. So this whole talk really is Subhuti. Let me just find out what that is. The word is, I think, anapatrapia and ahrikia. So they're the opposite. And there's something, I think the main point about them is there's something willful about them, yeah? It's not just that you haven't got a sort of sense of consciousness, it's that you sort of willfully ignore it. Yeah, you feel that little twinge of conscience, but you just kind of think, oh, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. Do people know that sort of, yeah? It's that kind of, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. So you, in the case of ahrikia, which is just the opposite of remorse, you sort of feel that into yourself. In anapatrapia, the opposite of apatrapia, you'd feel that in relation to someone you respect, yeah? And you might even, if you were feeling really kind of in one of those sort of sordid sort of moods, you know, you might even flaunt what you were doing. It's that kind of mood that you even say, oh, guess how drunk I got, like, guess what I did, you know. You're almost kind of willfully sort of holding up your unskillfulness. So that's the exact opposite of these. It's kind of, there's this notion in Buddhism, sometimes we talk about the far enemies and the near enemies. So the far enemy is something that's the exact opposite of the sort of positive quality. So that would be like the exact opposite. In a way, there's kind of not loads to say about that. Well, there probably is in a way, but we probably all know it. We probably know those myths when we go into the exact opposite. What I think is more interesting is what we call the near enemy. And the near enemy is always more interesting, I think, because it's sort of something that's it's a bit like the qualities, the positive qualities, but it's near enough to masquerade at it, but it's actually not it, but you can sort of imagine that it is. And I think the revelers who guiltily slink away are manifesting the near enemy. So if hri and apatrapia are a positive sense of remorse and and remorse of yourself, or positive sense of shame in relation to someone you look up to, well, what do you think? What do you think the near enemy is? What do you think this slinking away is?
Guilt.
Guilt, yeah. So guilt. So that's the thing that can masquerade as the real thing. So I'm going to spend a bit of time on this, just talking about what is the difference between guilty, sort of negative guilt, and positive shame. It's one of my favourite subjects, I think, because I've been so prone to that negative guilt myself in my life, and it took me quite a long time to... I don't even still think I've totally learned the difference, but hopefully I've learned a little bit about it. For a long time, before I was a Buddhist, and even actually after I was a Buddhist, but certainly before, I definitely used to think guilt was a virtue. I used to kind of feel that It was almost like the worse I felt about myself, the more virtuous I was. You know, if I felt really, really bad about something I did, I thought that was a good thing. But actually, looking back, I started to realise that what I was doing in feeling guilty, it kind of was a bit of a cop-out. I thought it was a virtue, but actually it was a cop-out. It was almost like I thought, if I feel bad enough about myself, it'll sort of prove I'm really sorry, but most importantly, no one else will have the heart to kind of tell me off or kind of punish me or something. Yeah, so it was almost like if I get myself first, they won't be able to get me. And I found this quote by Oscar Wilde that sort of says it all, really. He says, "There's a luxury in self-reproach. When we blame ourselves, we feel that no one else has a right to blame us." So that's quite sort of salutary, really, for those of us prone to guilt. So it was a bit of a shock to me to find out that guilt itself would be classed as an unskillful mental state in Buddhism. So we've got hri and apatrapi as a positive state, but we've got guilt as a negative state. So it's quite important to be able to learn to distinguish between them. And one of the reasons for this is that guilt, even though it feels horrible, isn't facing up to your own ethical behaviour. It's kind of quite perverse and convoluted, but even though it's unpleasant, that's why it's perverse, because it is unpleasant. I don't think anybody enjoys feeling guilty, but it is a way of, it's a sort of avoidance. And I find Bhante Sankaracharya's sort of identification of three things that have to be present for guilt really invaluable in learning to distinguish between guilt and remorse. He talks about this in his book called Transforming Self and World. So he says that, so here's the three things that need to be present for guilt. So I hope this list helps you. It's really helped me. So he said the first thing is that there has to be consciousness that you've done something wrong, in inverted commas, or at least done something that someone else didn't want you to do. Right, so that's the first step. Secondly, you're frightened that you're going to be punished when you're found out. Or, if you haven't done it yet, that if you did do it and you did get found out, you would be punished. I mean, that in itself already you can see is a can of worms that it's got the potential to lead to all sorts of secrecy and concealment and resentment, you know, against for the person that you think is going to punish you. But Sankaracharya says the third thing is probably the most telling one of all. And he said the third thing is that the person who doesn't want you to do the thing is someone you love and who loves you, is someone whom you're emotionally dependent, basically. And your fear that if you do what they don't want you to do, they won't love you anymore. Yeah. So that's what leads to guilt. And so it might be an actual person, or it might be a sort of internalised authority figure. I mean, I've really noticed that going on solitary retreat. I don't know if you've been on solitary retreat, but I noticed that even on solitary retreat, I could get guilt, even when there's nobody else there. No one's ever going to know what I did. I still have this internalised figure. Different people, you know, real people in my life, but I mean, they're not even there. But I'm still imagining they're judging me, and they're going to tell me I wasn't meditating enough, or I was meditating too much or something, whatever I'm doing, you know, and then in their eyes it's wrong, you know. Do people recognise that? Am I the only one? I find that quite a helpful list, really, to remember this. Especially that third one, to start to recognise. Yeah, just to start to notice, am I just trying to get someone's approval and love, basically? Is that what the feeling's based on? It kind of, it kind of gets us back to that old notion of sin. Even if we don't, even if we might think we don't believe in sin anymore, in a way, if we get the notion of guilt does really depend on the notion of sin, and the notion of sin depends on an outside authority. It's, you know, whole, it's a kind of a notion of obedience rather than consent. We sort of know intellectually that there isn't an external authority in Buddhism, and that means by sort of extension that there can't be a notion of sin, but, you know, as we know, even knowing things intellectually, you know, we might not know it deeply enough.
Yeah, I could say a lot more about that, but I don't want to run out of time, which I might do in a minute.
So yeah, maybe I'll just go back to, yeah, just this learning to tell the difference between that positive remorse, that positive shame that Uga felt that wakened him up, and the sort of guilt that caused the other friends to slink off. They can get mixed up, and probably for most of us, for a long time, they'll get mixed up with each other. We'll probably have bits of both in our consciousnesses. We can use that rule of that three-point sort of rule of Sangharakshita's. Another little, much smaller rule of thumb that I remember is, if you're trying to work out whether or not what you feel is guilt or this positive sense of hri or apatrapia, is that at the end of the day, guilt's a concern with yourself, and remorse in the healthy sense of hri or apatrapia is a concern with the other person. Yeah, so that's a kind of even simpler way to remember it. You can just see that quite pragmatically. Guilt causes us to go round and round in circles. Hri and apatrapia, you can just recognise it and then go, okay, it's a positive thing. It's because that I've got Shraddha that I feel this. I can be confident in that. So what do I need to do to get back in touch with Shraddha? So again, you can be quite pragmatic about it. So that's the sort of steps to take. So I'm going to just say a little bit more, because I've kind of been using hri and apatrapia a bit interchangeably, but I just want to finish off by sort of, there is a distinction between them. So I just want to finish off by saying a little bit more about this distinction. So hri or remorse is something that is felt kind of by yourself, as it were, internally. Apatrapia, as I've said, is something that you feel in relation to other people. So Uga felt it in relation to the Buddha. So it's important to realise that all the Buddha was doing was being himself. So at no point was the Buddha sort of telling Uga off or trying to reform him or anything like that at all. All the Buddha was doing was sitting meditating, and all he did was carry on sitting meditating. So that's important, because apatrapia, it is felt in relation to someone else, but it's not because that person is telling you off. And it's not because you're wanting that other person's approval. It's quite hard to put it into words, but I hope we've all felt it. I've certainly got people in my life who I feel, it's just simply that I, because they are much more skillful than me themselves, I just naturally don't want to be unskillful in their company. I just naturally, it's almost like I feel more grown up in their company, like they're kind of manifesting as a sort of integrated, mature, grown up person, and it's almost like their very being is saying, this is what life could be like, you could be like this. And I think, oh yeah, so I could, but it's quite natural. I hope I'm managing to convey that the most important thing is it isn't on the basis of wanting their approval. Because that person is more skillful, and certainly in the case of the Buddha doesn't give or withdraw his love, no matter how skillful or unskillful you are anyway. So it's not based on that. It's based on something that comes from you, but it's like it's triggered off by the presence of the other person. And more I've come to realize that actually this is probably more value. In a way, this is more of a way in than trying to just rely on any free or remorse that I feel myself, that I need my friends, basically. And that by actively putting myself in the presence of people that I do, well, look up to, that I do think of as spiritually more developed as me, it kind of, it sparks off the sense of apatrappi, which is, it's not always pleasant, but it definitely feels positive. So I think, to me, and I would suggest that that can be an important thing to cultivate, is to cultivate sort of situations where you're in the company of people that might spark off this apatrappi in you. So you can feel it in relation to individual people, but also I've come to value when I feel it in particular gatherings. So in the order, we regularly have order gatherings where we come together for a weekend or a day with other order members, or sometimes longer, sometimes a week or even 10 days. And I find that often apatrappi is just naturally sparked off. And it's not, again, I want to emphasize, it's not because anything's been said directly to me. It's not because somebody said, oh, so better matter, you're a bit unskillful there. Don't think any better, apologize. It happens much more spontaneous than that. It's often when I just walk into that order gathering and maybe everybody's meditating or doing a puja, I kind of think, oh goodness, gosh, that thing I said last week, it just kind of spontaneously comes into my mind and heart. And I think, gosh, I really need to apologise for that. And it's aroused by being in that company. And I think, again, I feel quite passionate about trying to communicate this, because I feel like it's not that easy to put into words why, for example, we have order gatherings, or for people who are mitras, we have mitra gatherings and mitra retreats. So maybe actually I could like indulge myself in a little advert just now about becoming mitras. We're about to have on Sunday some mitra ceremonies, and I won't embarrass them, but I know there's at least two people in this room about to have their mitra ceremonies on Sunday, and I know there's many of you that have taken that step, and some of you might be thinking about it. And well, some of you might not want to do it, and that's fine as well. But when you become a mitra, you know, we have things like mitra study and mitra retreats. And I always want to say, it's not that we don't have that mitra study because there's some special study that we're kind of withholding, that you don't get till you're a mitra. It's something, we do have a particular study course, but it's much more that one of the aspects is being in the company of other people who've also taken those spiritual steps. It can give rise to, it can draw you up. It can draw you up. And that drawing up can at times feel very pleasant and inspiring, but other times it can have that sort of, oh no, you know, am I worthy of this? You know, I need to do something to make myself worthy of this. And I mean this more, I mean this positively. It's not that the other people are thinking, oh, she's unworthy. They're kind of supporting you and being metaphor to you, hopefully. I'm sure they are. But it's something in you, yourself, that kind of thinks, oh, God, I'm going to have to live up to this now. I certainly feel that, particularly within the order. I'm going to have to live up to this. I hope I've been clear. So what I'm just to now finish off and give a little summary. So we started off with this, there's Ugar and his friends, and there's the Buddha. And they all encounter the Buddha, but out of all of them, Ugar is the one who has the positive response, but that is a painful response to him. He feels shame but it's positive, and we know that because then he sits down with the Buddha and is taught and transforms himself. So what we want to do is, first of all, learn to value that. Learn to value that feeling when we feel that positive sense of remorse. To value it, we need to learn to distinguish between that and the near enemy, which is guilt. So, and that's a whole lifetime's work, really. So we need to practice that, and we can use that checklist, especially looking at, are we trying to win approval? That's a sure sign of guilt, yeah? And then we just notice that. We don't give ourselves a hard time, but we think, ah, right, I've spotted you. I'm going to try and transform that. And then, but we might not, to have this feeling or emotion of free or positive remorse, we often are going to need the help of our friends. And that help can come in the form of simply putting ourselves in the company of those more developed than ourselves, and putting ourselves in the company of people who've made a spiritual commitment, because that will naturally draw that out. So that is that's what I got from this story of Uga meeting the Buddha, and I hope I've been able to share that with you. I'm sorry I've run out of time for questions. I thought I might, but I'll be sort of hanging around afterwards if that sparked off anything, if anybody wants to ask me anything. I'm going to wind up now, and thanks for allowing me to explore with you. Thank you.